Hello everybody and welcome to yet another oneliner.com podcast with me, Craig Eastman, and Glasgow as always, site editor Scott Morris.
Why, hello.
And in Falkirk as always, site contributor Drew Tavendale.
How do you do?
Got a fair old whack of stuff to get through this time, so we'll see how it goes. Remember, as always, podcast@theoneliner.com is the email address. Should anyone ever want to contact us, do us a favour, validate us. The directorial team of Mark Neveldine and Brian Taylor have made something of a name for themselves amidst the action genre with the Crank movies. Their over-the-top mix of low-cost, hyper-kinetic, handheld camera work, casual ultra-violence and massively tongue-in-cheek humour, earning them big kudos with both studio execs and paying audiences. With their unique style being frequently compared to that of a video game, it seems only natural that the directorial duo should be the ones to tackle Gamer, an action romp set in the near future, where professional video gamers take control of the minds of death row convicts as they fight in increasingly brutal fashion for the right to freedom. If elements of that formula sound familiar, it's probably because Neveldine and Taylor, also on scripting duties, seem to have drawn inspiration from every round of popular cinematic Mortal Kombat from The Running Man to Tron. Whether or not Gamer, with the increasingly popular Gerard Butler on leading man duties, can shed new light on these well-worn themes remains to be seen. And so I turn to Drew for the yay or nay. Drew, what's your impression of Gamer?
Nay.
Just once again, it's people who, the Crank films are astonishingly silly but deeply entertaining. But it's just yet another case of people being given a huge chunk of money and therefore ruining their concept for film. As we've seen so often before. Oh, what we're going to do with all this money, we'll spend it on lots of things and just make everything really dull. It's a stupid idea. It's like The Running Man meets a Second Life, and that just seems like a terrible idea, and it is a terrible idea.
No surprise there, then.
No, not at all. There's just none of the sort of daft charm of the Crank films. I mean, the Crank films are, I can see why people wouldn't like them, and I didn't think I would. They're stupid and they're ridiculous over the top, but they're played just right. And Gamer takes itself a bit too seriously. I think it thinks it's got something to say about control and people sort of putting their life elsewhere and all sorts of other internet-type fears, and it doesn't actually say anything in it. It doesn't have a plot. It's just somebody going around shooting somebody else, and I'd really rather play a video game because it's probably got more of a plot.
Scott, is there a deeper meaning to be found in Gamer, or is Drew correct?
Well, there's not. I thought it was, in terms of action scenes and chase frequencies, it's solid enough. It's perfectly acceptable entertainment. I don't really mind it on that level. My only real concern I've got is that it does try to play up the oddness a bit too much. There's all sorts of Daigle nonsense in this sort of Second Life analogue that's going on, and it's very odd and it's very funny for the most part, but it just doesn't really work when it also tries to bring in some drama towards the end of the film. Even when it's trying to have like some dramatic import, it's all at the same time undermining it with something strange with, like, I don't know, the head bad guy controlling a dance troupe of killers for comedy reasons, but that doesn't really work when you're trying to build drama at the same time. It's not exactly a staggering tale of heartbreaking drama, but if you just want to see things blow up, it's a decent enough choice. And as we said in the last podcast, it's the only cinematic portrayal of teabagging that I am aware of.
So at least get an extra star for that.
I had forgotten about that. It probably does.
It frequently taps the red button.
The thing is, though, I would say it is very like films like The Running Man and Death Race, where they're typical prisoners being used for entertainment and somebody tries to double-cross them so they don't actually get their reward or whatever. But there's already been a film this year that's actually done it better. And again, I can't believe I'm going to recommend a Paul W.S. Anderson film, but this sort of thing's your bag. Go and watch Death Race instead of this again.
Yeah.
I wasn't bored by it. Maybe it was a wee bit harsh, I find it reasonably entertaining, I suppose. I wasn't bored by it. It was just utterly pointless and just not as good as their previous works.
Yeah, pointless as Crank was, but pointless without a sense of humour in this case, by the sounds of it.
Well, not as much anyway. Yeah, I was like, more. The sense of humour was kind of the point of Crank, whereas in this, the things that are humorous are kind of, it's like Scott says, undermining what they're trying to do in the rest of it. It's kind of just too shallow, I guess. Stupid way to put it, but
I can't even be bothered making any terse video gaming analogies in summation, so there we are. Avoid Gamer. Victorian London was no place for an impressionable young lad, filled to the brim as it was with the stench of opulent excess and sordid debauchery. Unfortunately for Dorian Gray, he has just inherited a house in this sin city, and before long an unsettling transformation starts to occur. That's not to be confused with the transformation that happens when Eric eats a banana. Under the guidance of the morally ambiguous Lord Henry Wotton, Colin Firth, Gray soon finds himself succumbing to the more salubrious aspects of his new surroundings, his increasingly distasteful actions seemingly rendering him eternally youthful. When Gray finally finds himself confronted with potential true love, he has a difficult choice to make, the outcome of which just might decide the fate of his very soul. Scott, it all sounds rather ominous and scary, is it?
Well, obviously based on Oscar Wilde's seminal novel, it's not exactly to the letter of Oscar Wilde's work, but the first hour is at least close enough to the spirit to get the job done. It's good seeing Colin Firth in a decent acting role rather than a generic Hugh Grant replacement, and as a lead actor, Ben Barnes does better than I'd expected. The only problem comes in the last 45 minutes where the plotline decides to go and essentially make things up, and you have to have pretty big balls to think that, okay, if you've got something based on Oscar Wilde, you're going to just invent another 45 minutes to end it and expect it to be as good as what Wilde wrote.
Mm.
So even then, it's just feels a bit odd because it doesn't sort of gel into the time frame quite as well as the rest, and there's just something decidedly strange about the end of the film that doesn't really tie into everything that's gone before it. That said, it's still not terrible, though. I had horrible, horrible visions, especially some of the trailers of this looking like some sort of strange, almost comic book teen affair, as though it was like something out of The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
The posters made me fear that that was the case. I was kind of apprehensive because I hadn't seen this.
And, well, it's not. It's, for the most part, very good. The only problem I've really got with it in the end is, apart from just the strangeness of the end, is the fact that that end didn't need to be there anyway. It goes over to over 2 hours, and I see no reason for it when you've said everything that you need to say about the film and about society and about humanity adequately enough within 90 minutes, and the rest of it is just padding, and I don't really understand why it's there or what it's doing there. That aside, I do like the picture of Dorian Gray. It's a very good book, and if you've not read it, you're probably better off reading that than watching this film, but if you must watch a film based on it, this is quite a good choice. I, for the most part, rather enjoyed it, surprisingly so.
I haven't seen the original filmic adaptation Portrait of Dorian Gray, but...
there are several, Craig.
Well, yes. Is this one of the better ones, Drew?
You know, I can't actually remember having seen any of the other film adaptations. I've read the book a couple of times before, so I was pretty familiar with the story years since I read it. Although, yeah, as I said, I was really apprehensive because it did look like it was the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, Dorian Gray, going by the posters. Unfortunately, it's not. And it really is very good. It's very well acted. Ben Barnes gives a far more compelling performance in this than his silly accented swashbuckling in Prince Caspian. But as Scott said, the real surprise is Colin Firth, you know, for once proving that he can act and isn't just a cheap man's Hugh Grant. You know, Barnes, he makes a pretty good fist of making Dorian charming and likeable and almost sympathetic, which is no mean feat when, you know, apart from being a giant walking metaphor, Dorian Gray is an evil murdering bastard. There are a few other problems with it, but none that were deal breakers and suggesting that people should go and see it. The ending, Echo Scott's sentiments are, is tacked on and entirely unnecessary. Mm. There's also a pervasively intrusive score, and that's the one thing that really bothered me about it. I mean, it's proper music, not some Philip Glass-like audio torture, but its use in so many scenes is just entirely inappropriate. Rather than doing the sensible thing of letting Oscar Wilde's words convey the tone, something they are exceptionally capable of doing, the score surges after significant exchanges of dialogue, which just serves to undermine rather than reinforce the importance. And one major problem visually, in that towards the end of the film, which is set during World War I, the city doesn't look like 1910s London, it just looks like the Victorian London from the beginning of the film, with Lord Kitchener posters. So I'm guessing they ran out of money right about there, but
they hadn't invented MDF at that point, so they couldn't do any sort of quick makeover jobs.
Apparently not. But I mean, those are, compared to how the rest of the film is, fairly minor points. And I think possibly Oscar Wilde purists will probably want to avoid this, although the Emily Wotton character from the end has analogues in other screen adaptations, and it's at least based on the character in the novel, however loosely. So it's just that the scenes with her in the end of the film, there was no point in them being there. It didn't add anything to it, and just, in fact, it detracts. But yeah, it's worth a watch. If you like the book and aren't too bothered about the liberties the screenwriters sometimes have to take, the adaptations, I would recommend you go see it.
Well, I, for one, have neither read the book nor seen any of the previous adaptations, so I may make this my first port of call on a rainy day. We shall see. Sorority Row, then. You don't want to mess with Sorority House Theta Pi, or at least you certainly don't want to cheat on one of their number. One poor lad who does just that finds himself at the centre of a very unfortunate murder after a vengeful prank played on him by his girlfriend's university chums goes very badly wrong. The girls try to cover up the death, only to find their graduation a year later slightly marred by the arrival of a rather bothersome serial killer. Needless to say, Sorority Row is yet another 80s horror remake, but whether it deserves to be tarred with that particularly broad and derogatory brush is a matter for our crack review team. Drew, is it as bad as one would expect of a modern teen horror film?
Absolutely. It's awful. Now, I've not seen it, but I'm assuming that's the case.
In that case, for verification of a more tangible kind, I should ask Scott.
Well, there's not an awful lot to talk about in Sorority Row, which is...
Oh, you're joking!
Good, because I'm terribly lazy. Could be even lazier, and just call it I Know What You Did Last Summer with a higher number of Newell collegiates bouncing around in brand panties, and frankly, that sounds like a solid enough concept for a film to be. However, I suppose I'd better give you a bit of a brief pretense at professionalism here, so... Blah, 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 prank goes wrong, murder, blah, blah, hide the body, waffle, waffle, months later, psycho stalking, killing, blah, blah, blah. In a rare moment of fairness, I'd say it's no worse than the bulk of teen-orientated horrors that are out these days, and it's probably a bit more competently put together than most. The one thing that's going to kill it completely is that it's quite funny, which is odd. For the most part, it's being funny at exactly the moments where it's supposed to be scary. There's this one character has this sort of mile-wide thick of Generation Y-level detachment from everything that's going on and immediately delivers these sort of cutting barbs after every incident that happens and delivers these witty bon mots, and they are, for the most part, fairly funny. However, funny is not really what you want in the middle of a horror scene. It should be scary, or at least trying to be scary, rather than trying to be funny. So, in a way, I kind of liked it more than most horror films I've seen, because it at least kept me entertained by amusing me. It is, however, the exact opposite of what you want from a scary movie. Yes, so I don't really know who this is aimed at, but
perhaps in those moments of levity were there to counterbalance some sort of terrifying horror. Might it have worked better?
I suppose so. I mean, it's no worse executed in its executions than any other film that I've seen of this ilk. It's just that that's a very low bar to begin with.
Yes.
It doesn't do too badly with it, but as I say, it's the fact that it is so much funnier than it is scary just seems to be completely out of kilter. I have suffered through far, far worse horror films, but I can't actually recommend this to anyone because I don't really know what the target audience was supposed to be.
Might I pop in at this point and say that... I managed to catch up recently with Drag Me to Hell, which was the best horror film I've seen in a long time. I think that was the conclusion you guys came to when we reviewed it some podcasts ago. And it seems to manage humour and some genuine scares incredibly well. So save yourself the money on Sorority Row. Would that be the go and rent Drag Me to Hell instead? Would that be a suitable summation?
Absolutely.
That's what we'd recommend then. Flint Lockwood is a young, energetic and blindly enthusiastic inventor whose love of all things scientifically baffling hasn't sat too well with his fishing store-owning father. With a particularly ludicrous plan to turn water into food, thus solving the problem of world hunger, Flint risks alienating his widowed father for good, until, that is, he succeeds. After an accident leaves his contraption stuck in the clouds above his island home, Flint becomes a local hero when burgers, hot dogs, ice cream, and of course meatballs start raining from the sky. An opportunistic mayor has designs on corrupting Flint's good work for commercial touristic gain, and a potential romance with weather girl turned news reporter Sam Sparks seems likely to be scuppered at every turn. At least those are Flint's biggest concerns until a malfunction causes his machine to start producing increasingly gigantic proportions that threaten to swamp the town. Cloudy is a markedly different beast from its current peer group, focusing not so much on obvious child-friendly slapstick and silliness as it does on increasingly surrealistic events and dialogue. For this very reason, it seems to alienate a younger audience, or at least it did so at the screening I attended, but its skewed humour and moments of almost Cronenbergian body horror may well please adults more than most CG outings. Certainly any film that has a talking monkey taking up kung fu and ripping the jelly heart out of a giant gummy bear gets my vote from the get-go. An excellent voice cast that includes Andy Samberg, Anna Faris, Mr. T, James Caan, and the legendary Bruce Campbell goes a long way to helping matters, and I for one greatly enjoyed the lunatic 90 minutes Cloudy has to offer, though maybe not as much as I would have done had I not paid an extra £2 for the predictably pointless 3D incarnation.
Absolutely.
Gentlemen, would you differ from that opinion, Drew?
We'll start with the first thing, the last thing you mentioned there, just about the 3D.
Need we say anything?
I'm still very much of the opinion that at the moment 3D films are nothing more than gimmicks. And apart from Up, which we'll probably talk about in the next podcast, I've yet to see one that really benefits from technology. But bizarrely in this, there's so many films artificially have things moving towards the viewer simply to exploit the 3D factor. Hmm. But the plot of Cloudy allows for legitimate use of that, given that it's full of stuff falling from the sky. And it's curiously underused.
Mm.
But as for the rest of it, I didn't enjoy it quite as much as you, but there's a good few laughs in it. Its message about greed and consumption is about as subtle as a brick, but it doesn't serve to stop the fun, especially not when it has a monkey called Steve, as you talked about, voiced by the ever-brilliant, and it seems to be entirely unpretentious given that his role largely requires him to say, "Hungry, gummy bears, and Steve!" And little else, Neil Patrick Harris. The Jobsworth cop voiced by Mr. T, and as you mentioned, using the same word I was going to use, the legend that is Bruce Campbell as the town mayor.
That's got to be among the best animated voice casts we've seen recently.
Well, yeah, but for the most part, they were kind of having fun with it, and because a lot of the time, I think, and because Pixar have stopped using bigger names in the last few years, which is nice, because they don't really add anything, because you're not seeing them, it's all just about how they sound.
No, but didn't you think that Cloudy actually made sort of quite good use of the characteristics of its actors?
Yeah, I was coming around to that. I was just saying, on other things, I don't think it's really mattered, but in this, they've got sort of people you know, and it's actually made a difference. Mr. T clearly having fun.
Yes, although pleasantly.
I was, every second line, I kept expecting to say, "Get some nuts," because of those stupid Snickers adverts, but...
For the longest time, actually, because I wasn't aware of his involvement going into the film, and obviously, immediately as his character appears, you think, "Oh, that sounds an awful lot like Mr. T." But it was, I don't know what it was about his performance, but I had to sort of, I kept persuading myself that maybe it actually wasn't him. And
I think perhaps because
maybe he was having too much fun, and it was actually quite well. Obviously, the man's got a sense of humour, but it was sort of quite out of character for him.
Yeah, he's got quite a reputation as being a complete prat.
Yeah. That's probably it.
The stories you hear about him certainly suggest that his real-life character is more like Clubber Lang than it was the cop in Cloudy. But he's kind of funny. That sounds like Mr. T. Maybe it's just somebody doing a Mr. T impression.
Yeah.
But it's not. I was pleased to see just drop the rest of them. There are a few things I found a bit annoying. Oh, the main character spoke in a loud description of his actions grew tiring very quickly for me.
Quite enjoyed it.
But it's nowhere near enough to ruin the film, and it's balanced by some really quite amusing running gags. For example, a disaster movie mocking reference to which structures are damaged first in the film's climatic events.
My personal favourite line, "Let's carpe us some DM."
I just like to nod to what tends to happen in disaster films too.
Oh yes.
And I reckon kids will really like it, but the good thing about a lot of these films of late, the adults accompanying them aren't going to be bored, because I certainly wasn't. It's not great, but it's certainly decent at the very least, and well worth a watch.
I should say so. Scott, was that something that you would concur with?
Why not? Not seen it, but you know.
Excellent. Oh, I'm on a roll here. I would heartily recommend it if you've got a rainy afternoon to put paid to, just as we say, and as we no doubt will keep saying relentlessly in future podcasts, don't spend the extra money encouraging them to keep producing lame 3D versions of these things. The Final Destination. You know the drill by now. Teens cheat death in spectacular accident. Death comes back to put them through the mincer. Now with added 3D. Bang, and the plot is gone. I refuse to subject myself to the third installment of the franchise, let alone this fourth helping. Scott, is it a good job that the title would seem to hint at the end of all this stupidity?
Well, it's never going to be the end until it stops making money, is it?
No.
This, however, at least has the sense. I mean, you stopped at probably fairly sensibly at Final Destination 2, because Final Destination 2 was abysmal, and it was the stupidest idea for a film ever. if you did go and see three, you'd probably have noticed that they basically just got rid of all the stupid bullshit that made two crap and just went to killing teens in these bizarre Byzantine mousetrap-esque fashions. And taken as that, I mean, you know what you're into when you're going into the thing. It was okay. It's perfectly fun entertainment. Final Destination 4 3D, whatever you want to call it, is essentially the same formula again, but in 3D. Now, is there a place for that in cinema? There's probably a space for at least one film every, I don't know, 2 years where it just, without any rhyme or reason, just starts killing people. Why not? There's no point grafting flimsy excuses on when they don't need to. in this case, I've... That's why I liked the first film. It was just refreshingly straightforward and just being, right, we don't really, really care about the plot. We're just going to come up with some interesting ways to kill people. And none of the sort of, ooh, it's a critique on humanity bullshit that Saw was trying to do or any of that nonsense. It just thought, right, we'll try and kill people off. This is probably the most natural fit for 3D effects that I can possibly think of because it is a daft gimmick tacked on to a daft gimmick of a franchise series. So they just mesh quite well, and it does some very interesting things. I don't know if it was presented in terrifying 3D the way that Scar was, but it was certainly in 3D, and there is something to be said for people being in, falling out of the sky and impaling themselves on something, and sort of popping out and almost hitting you in the eye. It's probably a more interesting, and certainly a far more visceral use of 3D than anything else I've seen. The story itself, there's no real story itself. It's just the usual daft accident setups and deaths out of nowhere that the previous franchise has done so well. So if you've got even the slightest interest in the previous films, apart from two, which is a special case of suck, why not go and see it in 3D? It's the only time I've seen where 3D would actually make a film more interesting rather than just hurt your eyes. And in that respect, it's probably the biggest recommendation that I can give it. I mean, I didn't even think 3D enhanced up all that much. I think it's a ridiculous gimmick, and I'm getting really tired of having my nose hurt from those crappy glasses. So, yeah, why not? Again, it's one of the other sort of halfway decent horror films that I've seen this year, so take of that what you will.
Take of that what you will, indeed. I shan't rush out to see it, but who knows? Maybe if I'm feeling particularly vengeful against myself, I'll pop it in a DVD player at some juncture soon. Imagine a world in which lies just simply do not exist. Dating couples exchange immediate and frank first impressions. Work colleagues openly express their contempt for you. Suicidal loners outline their intent to down a bottle of painkillers that evening. And if there's a problem with the computer at the bank, a teller will hand you as much money as you request on faith. Or maybe faith is the wrong word, as co-writer-director Ricky Gervais is a man openly sceptical of religion, and in the parallel universe of the invention of lying, it simply cannot exist without the notion of the fib. Predictably, Gervais's film, in which his central character Mark Bellison soon begins to reap the rewards of having discovered how to lie, has come under increasing fire in America for its staunchly anti-religious stance. This is entirely unfair, as it should be coming under fire due to the fact that it's just not that good a movie.
Yep.
That Gervais's Bellison becomes a messiah after inventing the notion of an afterlife to comfort his terminally ill mother seems of oddly little consequence, and it's somewhat ironic that at this point the movie begins to lose its focus. A promising opening reel in which Bellison attempts to woo the clearly out of his league Anna, played by Jennifer Garner, soon gives way to what is essentially a bog-standard rom-com, minus all of the rom and most of the com. Mark and Anna's relationship proves inherently unlikable, with Garner's character essentially devoid of charm, wit or warmth, and it soon becomes impossible to root for the couple, especially as Bellison's hostile colleague at script agency, Brad, played by Rob Lowe, proves a narcissistically perfect match as a rival for Anna's intentions. There are two moments of genuine emotion in the film, both points that would prove potentially devastating were the surrounding material more amusing in contrast. As it is, they feel squandered by the flatness with which Gervais and creative partner Matthew Robinson both write and direct, and the overall result is a step backward from the flawed but vastly superior Ghost Town. Numerous cameos from Gervais' celebrity friends list can't quite save an otherwise doomed vessel, and a brief appearance from his frequent writing partner Steve Merchant can't help but raise the question of how much better this might have been with his own creative involvement. For a committed Ricky fan such as myself, this has been a bitter disappointment. Scott, disappointment for you?
Well, I am not much of a Ricky Gervais fan in the first place, so it wasn't all that surprising to me to not find this funny in the slightest, but it's just a strange concept for a film. It does completely lose focus once it hits this whole religion nonsense, which is just a sidetrack it should not have went down. It's painfully unfunny, and the problem with the film is the whole film is painfully unfunny, and I thought when you first hear the concept of this world where the underlying hasn't been invented, you might think, that's a okay idea for a premise, but it turns out it's not, because it immediately means that there can't be any jokes in it, because jokes are basically lies. So what Gervais has done is write a film where he is the only character who can possibly be funny, which is a bit narcissistic, I find. Plus, it just leads to these strange situations where he's going to Anna, oh, you're so wonderful and warm and caring, when she absolutely
when she's not.
Isn't. And for once, this is not a knock on Jennifer Garner's atrocious acting ability. It is just the fact that you cannot possibly be those things in this world. It's like the script doesn't actually realise what world it is that he's in. Which is odd, given he made the world in the first place. But aside from all these other niggles, the main thing is, it's supposed to be a comedy, and it's not funny in the slightest. There's, what, three decent gags in the whole thing? Two names and one thing where he opens the door dressed as Jesus. Rest of it, crap.
I detect no small amount of vitriol there, Drew. I'm almost scared that I ask Scott. What's your opinion?
Well, first of all, I seem to come pretty much right in the middle of you and Scott's opinions of Ricky Gervais, because I think he's decidedly all right. It can be a bit much, but so I come in the middle. But yeah, I kind of like the premise of the film. It's very high concept, I thought, but that might work. And then it's like they just abandoned the concept once they started writing it because they couldn't think of anything to do with it. Made it, as you said, a rom-com without much of either the rom or the com. I'm not going to spend much time saying much more. Either you or Scott have said there's not much point. It's just not funny. It's all you need to know. It grinds to a halt when it introduces the religion thing, because it's not a funny satire. It's just bludgeoning people with this big, listen, this religion nonsense. And I happen to think religion is nonsense, but it's just been done so much better before.
I don't think anyone who's seen The Office or Extras can deny that Ricky Gervais is he's a very talented man, both in direction and in his writing. He's of no small comedic caliber. But my ultimate summation of this is that he's come up with a concept here that's just too steep for him to climb.
Yeah, he's come up with a concept. I have no idea what to do with it.
Yeah, there's no getting over how high concept this is. It literally diffuses every potential situation just by necessity of itself.
Yeah, and it's just in the end, it's just resorted to sight gags, like Scott mentioned them. Turned to come to the door dressed as Jesus, which, unless you're really stupid, you've worked out as soon as he steps out of bed.
That's a topic that he himself cares so much about. I don't mean vehemently anti-religious in a sort of a vitriolic way. He's quite clearly finds the whole notion of religion quite amusing. And that, given that he's stated that that's the intent of this film, is that that's the key theme of it, to have to resort to basically sight gags of opening a door dressed in a white robe and just not having shaved for about 8 weeks. Surely he can come up with better than that.
Apparently not.
Yeah, I know.
No.
It's the ridiculous thing too. I mean, probably the funniest scene in it is the scene with Barry off EastEnders and Stephen Merchant. but it's at that point, it's like it grinds to a halt, stops being a film, because Stephen Merchant's got a silly goon face that you just can't take seriously in any sort of film at all.
It works and fine. The pipe.
It works fine in Extras, but it's like that suddenly stopped and become a TV comedy sketch for a few minutes with Barry off EastEnders and Stephen Merchant. And then, oh, we best get on with this film then. And that's the funniest bit in it, but it's a bit least like a film.
Not necessarily the funniest scene, but the scene that I think worked the most in evoking any kind of emotion was the scene where he's in the lift with your fella from Superbad. Is it Josh something?
Jonah Hill.
There was quite a touching scene there. I think the second time I'm correct in saying name eat. And it took me off guard, but I couldn't help but think that you should either go down that road entirely or at least craft a film that's funny enough round about it that scene actually has some genuine impact, because it was a rare moment of sort of skill both in the writing and in the acting in an otherwise barren desert of, well, I say barren desert of humour, but it's just a barren desert. There's no humour there.
I was very disappointed. Some odd cast members there, really, given how not funny and just how not good the film was, I couldn't work out what they were doing there. Edward Norton and Philip Seymour Hoffman.
What?
In really, really small roles too. Like, why?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's he's called in obviously a few favours, but I mean, the mind boggles as to whether these people just agreed outright or if they actually read the script first.
I don't know, because you've got like Philip Seymour Hoffman, who, in my eyes, can pretty much do no wrong, and he turns up as a bartender to talk about touching boobs. That's what he's there for.
That's, I mean, it was probably an enjoyable day off from his normal work. For, I dare say, Philip Seymour Hoffman, as brilliant an actor as he is, I mean, I dare say the weight of the material that he would normally deal with probably gets to him, and every now and again he wants to cut loose and just talk about boobs, but...
Also, it's not exactly a rewarding role, though, surely.
No, absolutely not, but I don't know, maybe he got a little trip to London out of it, or who knows, but there was also this curious notion of it. Is it just me? Was a film supposed to be set in America, but people were talking about pounds and dollars almost in the same sentence?
Notice that actually.
Anybody else pick up on that? I'm gonna have to double check this. I was kind of waylaid by the mediocrity of it all, but I'm sure the sort of the available currency veers from scene to scene between pounds and dollars. It seems to be set in America, yet he takes pounds out at the bank.
No, he definitely said dollars.
Did he say dollars? I'm sure he speaks about pounds elsewhere. And I don't know. His mother seems to be English. Everyone else.
Oh, well, he's English. So clearly he's moved there.
He's English. He's English. His mother and a lot of his friends. Yeah, a lot of other people seem to be English, and everyone else seems to be American. I don't know where this film is set. Who knows? That's the least of its problems. Well, that's the end of another podcast then. We've tried to keep it short and sweet so we don't bore you senseless. Keep it real. We'll be back at the next available juncture. But until then, I, as always, have been Craig Eastman. Scott was Scott.
Bye.
And Adaru was Adaru.
Adieu.
Adieu.
Adaru. Adieu, Daru. Yeah, keep it vaguely real. Bye. And now, not an interlude from Drew Tavendale.